This morning's scripture reading will be from Ephesians chapter 5, verses 15 through 16. Look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise, but as wise, making the best use of the time, because the days are evil.
Good morning. We all lost something last night, didn't we? Yes, you laugh because you know exactly what I'm talking about, right? We lost an hour, just gone like that. 2 a.m. in the morning, a thief in the night came and stole it, ripped it from us. We left wondering, why am I so tired this morning? We had our kind of the young families class and the young adult class in the fireside room this morning. Last week we had a room full of people, a crowded fireside room, and this morning walk in as class is supposed to start and there are three of us. Look around. This is what happens when you lose an hour of sleep and you have young kids. Eventually people filtered on in, but that's the reality. But it's not just that daylight saving time, is it? It kind of thing happens all of the time. Like, have you ever found yourself in the middle of a work day or the middle of an afternoon and you look down at your watch and is it really 3 o'clock already? Like, where did the time go? Has anyone had that experience? Okay, I'm not alone. I want you to fill in this sentence. There's just not enough time. Yes, you could also say money, but that's a sermon for another time. You could say love, that's a sermon for another time. But there is just not enough time. We all feel that crunch, right? We all feel kind of the pressure of to-do lists and clocks that just keep ticking and ticking and ticking. See, I did us a favor this morning. I put a clock up on the screen with a minute hand or an hour hand or whatever that is that's just staying still. You know, imagine if you just saw it ticking away the entire time. Now, I know some of you are looking at your watch when I stand up to preach and you're watching the seconds tick by as it is. That's a whole different story. But we've all felt that there's just not enough time. Have you ever had the experience of trying to get kids out the door on time? There's just not enough time. Amanda and I are thinking about getting these shirts for our kids. If you can't read it, they both say, "I'm the reason we're late." That is the reality that we live in. See, we started our class this morning late because we know there's a time crunch, that we just don't have enough time. And we feel it. And we can kind of laugh and joke about it, but it's real. Like, it is a pressing weight that a lot of us feel, or at least I do. There was a morning back a couple weeks ago, I woke up and I grabbed my cup of coffee and I grabbed my Bible and I went to my lounge chair to sit down to pray, and I was just distracted. Like, I could not focus at all. My heart was just kind of beating a little bit faster. My breathing was a little bit more shallow. And so I sat down, or I grabbed my notebook and my pen, and I just started writing out the things I needed to do. Like, I could not focus, and so, like, okay, I need to do a mental dump. Just get it all on the page, and started writing out everything I had to do, and went through a page and then flipped over and another page, and I, as I was doing it, like, I could feel myself getting stressed out. I could feel myself just getting short of breath, and so I just stopped. Like, I got to like 52, I think, and I just stopped, and I'm pretty sure I've been short of breath ever since. I say that not so that you feel pity for me. I say that so you know that I don't have this all together either. I want us to nerd out for a second and talk about the history of time, not from the beginning of time to now, but the history of keeping time and a little bit of the psychology of it. Did you know that clocks were invented by monks? They're invented by monks in their monastery so that they could keep track of the hours at which they would pray. And they wanted a way to kind of structure their day around prayer. And so they invented clocks so that they could pray. In 1370, the first public clock, as we know it today, was put up in a public place. And historians tell us that that moment in 1370 marked a shift in society's relationship to time. Because before that, our relationship to time was primarily natural. Our time was based on the sun. It was based on the rotations of the earth. It was based on when the sun went up. It was based on when the sun went down. But when we introduced the clock, it created artificial time, where we now pay less attention to what time does the sun get up and more attention to what time we set our alarm in the morning. It happened in 1370. And then historians tell us that in 1879, our relationship to time shifted again. Does anyone know what happened in 1879? You didn't do research, I did. I'll tell you. Edison invented the light bulb. And when Edison invented the light bulb, it shifted the way we related to time. Specifically, it shifted our relationship to sleep. Does anyone want to guess how much the average American slept before Edison invented the light bulb? 11 hours. 11 hours was the average time that Americans slept before the invention of the light bulb. I don't know about you, but my alarm that I use is an app on my phone, and it tells me how long I have until the alarm goes off. And if I get it at 7 hours, I'm feeling pretty good about myself. It shifted the way that we relate to time. And then about a century ago, as technology shifted and we felt the everyday effects of the Industrial Revolution, new technologies came into our world that were called labor-saving devices. These tools and pieces of equipment that were designed to save us work and to save us time. And a lot of them are good things. It used to be that when you woke up in the morning and it was a little bit chilly in your house, you'd have to go outside and you'd have to chop wood, or you'd have to go into the basement and shovel coal into the furnace. But now what do most of us do? We go and we press a little button on our wall and magic happens, and all of a sudden our house gets a little bit warmer. It used to be that when you wanted to communicate with someone, you had to pull out this thing called a piece of paper and this device called a pen, and you wrote what was in history called a letter. Now we have Siri and we have text messages. It used to be that if you wanted to cook something, you would have to go outside, find it, kill it, skin it, bring it inside, and then cook it. And then you'd have to clean up by hand all of what you've done. We have all of these labor-saving devices. And in fact, in the 1960s, everyone thought that we would be working much fewer hours. In 1967, there was a Senate subcommittee meeting that said by 1985, the average American would work 22 hours per week for 27 weeks a year. Like, do the math on that vacation time. They thought that all of these labor-saving devices, all of this technology would lead to this overabundance of leisure time. But if you study it, and there are people who do, from 1973 until now, our leisure time has decreased by 37%. Which means we spend less time going fishing. We spend less time throwing the ball in our yard with our kids. We spend less time going to the park and going for a walk. And yet, from 1960 till now, we have a significant higher amount of free time. And so the question is, where did all of that time go? Because what did we say when we started? There's just not enough time. So where did it go? Well, the answer is we spend it on different things. See, the pinnacle of the time-saving device that has shifted our relationship to time came in 2007. There was something introduced into the world in 2007 that sociologists and historians tell us shapes the way we not only relate to time, but the way we relate to what it means to be human. Does anyone know what it was? Yes, iPhone. 2007, Steve Jobs stands on a screen or on a stage and he introduces the world to an iPhone, this device that is supposed to make life so much better. And yet there was a study done 2 years ago that said the average iPhone user touched their phone 2,617 times a day for an average of 2.5 hours. Now, if you focus on millennials and young adults and teenagers, that number skyrockets to well over 5 hours a day spent on this, quote, time-saving device. This leads psychologists to characterize our relationship with our time-saving devices, particularly with our phone, as compulsory behavior. If someone were, I shouldn't say this because they're going to do it. If someone were to text me right now, do you know what I would feel compelled to do? Don't do it, Luke. It's on Do Not Disturb. I would be compelled to check it. If your phone goes off right now, you're going to be compelled to check it. You're just going to feel like this ache, this desire to check it. When you are standing in line at the grocery store and you're bored, what do? You probably pull out your phone and you check your email or you check Facebook. That becomes compulsory behavior. See, all of this works together to cause psychologists and mental health professionals to characterize this relatively new phenomenon that they call hurry sickness. It is, in a kind of mental health and psychology world, an almost disease-like phenomenon. They call it a behavior pattern characterized by continual rushing and anxiety. They also say it's when a person feels chronically short on time and so tends to perform every task faster and tends to get flustered when encountering any type of delay. And Philip Zimbardo, who is a PhD psychologist, gives several symptoms of hurry sickness. So I want you just to do a mental check to see if this connects with you at all. You move from one checkout line to another because it's shorter. Anybody ever do that? I know you have, don't lie. We're in church. You come to a stoplight and you count cars in front of you and then you change lanes so you can get through it faster. You multitask to the point that you forget one of the tasks. Anybody? That is a story of my life. You accidentally put your clothes on inside out or backwards. A few of you, I don't know that I've done that, but I have put a box of cereal or peanut butter in the refrigerator multiple times. And then here's another one, sleeping in your daytime clothes in order to save time, whether that's just not taking the time to change into pajamas before you go to bed or putting your work clothes on when you go to bed so you save that extra little bit of time in the morning. These are all signs of what psychologists call hurry sickness. I was reading a book on spiritual formation for church leaders and people in spiritual leadership on a Saturday afternoon a few weeks ago, and the author lays out seven spiritual signs that indicate that we are moving through life too quickly. I want to see if you relate to any of these. Irritability. You're just kind of living on edge. Or hypersensitivity, that you're easily offended or that you get upset very easily. Or restlessness, like when you sit down to relax, you can't actually relax. Or compulsive overworking. Just put in hour after hour after hour thinking if you just get this next thing done, then it'll finally be all better. Or emotional numbness, the inability to love, the inability to feel joy or happiness or anything of the sort. Or escapist behaviors, things like binge-watching TV or excessive social media usage or excessive alcohol or excessive eating. Being disconnected from your identity or calling, or not being able to attend to basic human needs like sleeping enough or exercising or eating well, or hoarding energy, this idea that I have so much to do that I just can't do anything right now so I can save energy so I can do all of those things, or slippage in spiritual practices, where disciplines, things like prayer and Bible study and church attendance begin to fall on the wayside when they become less and less frequent. I don't know about you, but I stand in front of you able to say, that sounds a whole lot like me. I was in Walmart just a couple days ago, preaching this sermon to myself again and again and again. And it was a long day, had been a long week. I was several hours behind where I wanted to be. I just wanted to get home, but we needed a few errands. And I was on one side of Walmart and needed to get to the other side of Walmart. And so I walked down the aisle, and then I get behind slow walkers. Like, I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but like I wanted to just go. Like I just wanted to get to the other side, and these people were just meandering on by, and I could feel it just rising. I could feel it. See, all of that to say that our relationship with time is all out of sync, and I don't think I'm alone in that. Our relationship with time is just messed up. So a few thoughts on time before we get into our text that I think is important for us. First is the fact that we always make time for what we value, and we neglect the things we don't value. You know what I'm talking about. If something is important for you, you are going to find time to do it. Like as much as we feel this time crunch, as much as we feel like we just can't get it all done, if it's important to you, you will find time to do it. A lot of us are just waiting for the next season of life, aren't we? If I can just get to, I can't tell you how many times I've thought to myself, well, if I can just get to the place where the kids are a little bit older and they can start taking care of themselves a little bit, then I'll have more time. Or when I was in college thinking about if I can, or when I was in high school thinking about if I can just get done with football practice and track practice and my job at Respects, then I'll have more time. And then I show up in college and realize that college is kind of hard and I have to study and I have to get a job because college is really expensive and I have a relationship that I want to try to maintain with Amanda and if I can just get through this season, then I'll have more time. And then graduate from undergrad, get married, start ministry, and realize, contrary to what Carson Johnson might tell you, ministry requires more than 1 hour a week on a Sunday morning, that it's actually very busy, and it takes work to maintain a good, healthy marriage, and that there are jobs to do at home and chores. If I can just get through this next season, and then a baby shows up, then maybe another baby. Or we think, if I can just get to retirement, then I will have more time. But then we get there and we realize that we have a honey-do list that's a mile and a half long that we need to get done. See, we don't get to decide how much time we've been given. There's just as much time today as there's ever been. There are 24 hours in a day, 1,440 minutes, 86,400 seconds in a day. You will not have any more time or less time than you do right now. All that's left for us to decide is what we will do with the time that is given us. A quote attributed to J.R.R. Tolkien. And so, we come to our text, to Ephesians chapter 5, what Caleb read for us. It's very straightforward, but let's read it again. He says, "Be careful then how you live, not as unwise, but as wise, making the most of every opportunity, because the days are evil." This is incredibly simple, incredibly straightforward. I want us to unpack this just a little bit. First of all, I want us to notice that what he's talking about here is a lifestyle. In some translations, he says, "Be careful then how you walk," which is an ancient idiom for your lifestyle, for the way that you live. This isn't talking about self-help tips. It's not about kind of pop psychology or motivational psychology. This isn't productivity seminars on TED Talk or whatever. This is a lifestyle. He's calling us to structure and live our life a certain way. And notice, the way he calls us to structure our life is on wisdom. So be careful then how you live, not as unwise, but as wise. What is wisdom? Well, wisdom is basically applied knowledge. It is taking what we know and putting it into practice so that we might live a successful and fulfilled life. And the value of wisdom is all over the scriptures. In fact, there's an entire book dedicated to it. In Proverbs, wisdom is said to be of more value than gold. Wisdom should be chased and it should be pursued. It should be desired more than any treasure the world has to give us. So Paul invites us and he calls us to live a lifestyle of wisdom. But notice also the reason why we need to live a wise life is because the days are evil. We live in difficult times. Paul did. Paul was able to look at his world and see the violence and see the injustice, to see the greed and the immorality all around him. He's able to say the days are evil. When we look at the world around us, we see those same things. We live in evil days. And so this calls us to live a lifestyle of wisdom. And so just pause for a second and think about the way that you're living your life. Think about the way you spend your time. Think about the way you spend your money. Think about the interactions you have with people, particularly interactions with people that you disagree with, particularly on like social media. Are you living a lifestyle of wisdom? We are called to live not as unwise, but as wise, because the days are evil. But then notice that the way we live a lifestyle of wisdom in evil days is to, quote, make the most of every opportunity. And that is the heart of this text, isn't it? And we are to make the most of every opportunity. And so this is the heart. So let's unpack this idea, this phrase a little bit. Stick with me for just a few minutes. We'll get to some practical stuff here in a minute. But I want you to underline that phrase, make the most of every opportunity. And then I want you to write in the margins of your Bible three words if you write notes. The first is redeem, then opportune, and enslaved. I think those words help us understand the depth of what's happening here. Most modern translations talk about making the most of the opportunity or making the most of the time. But if you've got an old King James, it uses the phrase redeem, which is a particular word in the ancient language that means to purchase out of. That's the word that Paul uses here, to purchase out of. It's this marketplace term used when someone would purchase someone else out of slavery. And that's the word that Paul uses here for our relationship to time. It is purchasing out of slavery our time. The word time in the original language is the Greek word kairos. Say that word for me, kairos. You guys are experts in Greek now. It is not the kind of time that we often think of. When you think of time, what do you think of? You look down at your watch that's stuck on your jacket, and you realize that you only have a few more minutes left to preach. You see the second hand ticking away. But this kind of time isn't talking about a unit of measurement. It's not talking about wristwatches. It's not talking about sundials. It's not talking about time the way we often think of. This is the idea of an opportune time, or a destined time, or a predetermined time, or the right time. It is time that is brimming with power and with potential. It's like the harvest time. When they would say it's harvest time, you don't mean that it's Tuesday at 3 o'clock on August 2nd. You mean that it's ready. The crops are ready to go. It's ready to harvest. And if you don't get going, you are going to miss that opportunity. That is the idea here, that the time is slipping away, not just in seconds ticking off the clock, but in opportunities are slipping away in front of us. And notice those opportunities, that time is enslaved. That's why we have to redeem it. This time, these opportunities are in enemy territory. They're not in neutral ground. And if we don't actively try to seize the opportunities in front of us, wickedness and evil and busyness and darkness will swallow those opportunities. We need to step into the moment, evil though it might be, and redeem that time. See, that is the picture that Paul has here. And so let's talk for a little bit about how we can actually do this, how we can redeem the time. If you take notes, the first one is this: and we need purpose and we need urgency. In Psalm 90, verse 12, the psalmist prays that you might teach us to number our days, O Lord, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. There's a certain way of life that comes from knowing that your days are numbered, isn't there? When you live knowing that every second that passes is a second that you will never get back, it changes the way that you relate to time. when we understand that there is only so much time left, it should give us purpose and it should give us urgency. It should give us this drive, this desire to make the most of the time that we have been given, because we can never get it back. Read an article a while back about a nurse. It was written by a nurse who spent her time in hospice care, caring for patients in their last days. And she spent days and weeks with them. She got to share these really intimate moments as they shared some of their regrets, some of the things that they would go back and do differently. Do you know what most of those things had to do with? They never said, "I wish I would have worked more." Never said, "I wish I would have put in more time at the office." Were always things like, "I wish I had the courage to live according to my true self instead of others' expectations. I wish I stayed in touch with my friends a little bit better. I wish I had given more time to my family." See, we live with purpose and with urgency because we know that we can't get our time back. There's only so much time in the world. Do we really want to waste it on things that don't matter? Do we really want to waste away the seconds we have been given on Netflix and on social media and on complaining and on grumbling and on all kinds of these things that don't matter? Every time you dedicate yourself to do something, you will never get that time back. And so don't procrastinate. Live with purpose and live with urgency. But that should also drive us to prioritize. Now, this might come as a shock to some of you. If you were type A, you're going to leave here and try to prove me wrong. But you can't do everything. You just cannot do everything. God has placed limits in your life, and those limits are not bad things. You're not going to get everything done, and that is okay. But you also have to understand that God will not give you more to do than he has given you time in which to do it. Which means, as you take a look at your to-do list of 532 things, and you look at the calendar and you look at the clock and you say, there's just not enough time, then maybe, just maybe, some of those things on your list are not things that God expects you to do at all. They are things that you have placed on your life that you need to just let go of. See, as we look at our list, as we look at all of the things that we need to do, there are some things that are just more important than others. And we need to move those more important things up. For me, the framework that I use to understand my priorities is that God comes first. And anything having to do with God comes first. That's why I personally start every day with my coffee, my Bible, and time in prayer. If I don't do it then, I don't know that I'll ever do it. But then family comes next. That time with my family and being there for my family, doing what I can for my family comes next. And then everything else comes after that. So that means there are some things that are good that I want to do that I just can't because I don't have time. I don't have the ability to do it. And then as you look at your list, there are some things on it that only you can do. Only you can parent your children. Dads, only you can be a dad to your kids. Nobody else can do it. Moms, only you can mother your child. There are other people who might be able to do that project at work, but only you can be there for your kids. Some things only you can do, and those need to be moved to the head of the list. And there are other things that are less important, but they're still valuable. They still matter. So they still need to be on your list, but you move them to the bottom. And if you don't get to them, then obviously they were not all that important in the first place. And listen, that's okay. It is okay if you don't get everything done, if you are operating with the right priorities. And then other things just don't need to be on your list at all. They just don't need to be there. I keep in my Evernote file a folder I call Someday Maybe. Because I have a thing about, I think I should do something. I want to write it down, and I can't just kind of throw it in the trash. And so what I do is I put it in a someday maybe folder that says, someday maybe I might get to it. I haven't checked it in about a year. I'm never going to get it. But it's there, and it makes me feel a little bit better. And maybe that's something that you need to do. But then number three, we need a plan. And we need a rule We need to operate with a certain set of guidelines. And now every time I say you need a plan, you know, you need rules and structure in your life, the response is always, but doesn't that mean I can't be spontaneous? Like, I just want to go with the flow. Well, a good plan guided by purpose and priorities gives you the freedom to be spontaneous. When you structure your life according to the purpose God has given you based on the priorities that you've developed, you get a plan. And that plan allows you to be who God has made you to be and do what God has made you to do. If we don't do that, we end up spending all of our time on urgent things that just aren't important. Dwight Eisenhower used this kind of decision-making matrix that was made popular in one of the self-help books from the 90s, where all of the things we do in life fall in one of four categories. They can be urgent and important. Isabel fell and hurt her arm back a few weeks ago. It was an urgent thing. It needed to be dealt with now, and it was important. But other things are important. They're not urgent. Things that you need to do that aren't pressing, you're not up against a deadline. And then other things are important, or are not important, but they're urgent. These are all the phone calls and the text messages and the things that just kind of pop up, like, I need you to do this right now, that ultimately aren't all that important, but they are urgent. And other things aren't important and aren't urgent. And without a plan, we end up spending most of our time in quadrant three with things that aren't important but are pressing. A plan allows us to prioritize. And so we live with a plan, we live with purpose. But then number four is the pruning of distraction, the ruthless elimination of all that's unnecessary. We need an acute self-awareness. We need to know our limits. We need to know what we're capable of and what we're not. We need to know those things that get us off focus and off mission, and we need to get rid of everything else. We need to reduce life to the essentials. See, the key to making the most of the time isn't by doing more. It is often by doing less so you can do what is most important. And there is freedom in reducing life to the essentials and getting rid of all of the distractions. For me, it has meant getting rid of our TV, like a lot of people. Would come home from work, a stressful day, a lot of thinking, my mind is just kind of numb and would want to sit down in front of a TV and just watch it. It was a weakness for me. Like, this isn't about my strength, it was a weakness for me. And so we had to get rid of it. Had to limit what I allow on my phone as far as apps go, because I know my weaknesses. Find out what is wasting your time, what is getting you off focus, and get rid of it. You don't need it, and your life will be better because of it. But then we need presence in the moment. We need to learn how to be here again. So often we find ourselves somewhere else. We find ourselves at work and we're thinking about home, and then we get home and we find ourselves thinking about work, or we're in church and we find ourselves thinking about lunch. We need to learn how to be here again in the moment, because this is the only moment that we have. Isabel has a heartbreaking way of reminding me of this. There are times where I just don't get everything done in the day. I'll bring my computer home and we'll have dinner. I'll sit down in the couch and I'll pull up my laptop while Isabel's playing there in the playroom. And she will come up and just close the top of my laptop. She calls it an iPad. She says, "No iPad, no iPad." And I'll get frustrated. "Isabel, just let me finish. Let me send this email. Let me." And I'll try to open it, but she pushes it down. And then I realize, I need to be here, not there, not in the future, not last week. I need to be here because it's the only moment that we have. And then we need presence to the presence of God. We need to learn to cultivate a constant awareness of and connection to God's presence. Right now, this moment is the moment that God has made available to us to experience his presence. Right now, God is here. God is with us. If you are a follower of Jesus who has been baptized into his blood, he is in you, in this moment. Sure, he's everywhere. He is omnipresent in the words of theology. But he is here with us in this moment. If you want to make the most of the time, then cultivate this awareness that wherever you are, whatever it is you're doing, no matter how pressing the list might be, no matter how quickly those seconds are ticking away, that God is here. As we bring ourselves to that moment, we are in relationship with him. In the words of Jesus, we abide in the vine, and that is where we bear fruit. See, I don't want you to think of this as a self-help sermon. This isn't motivational psychology. This isn't productivity tips. I can recommend you a lot of books that will be a lot more powerful than a few things I've shared this morning. It's an invitation. Paul says in 2 Corinthians 6 that I tell you now is the time of God's favor. Now is the day of salvation. See, church, this is the Kairos moment. This is the opportune time to do that which God has placed in front of us, to experience peace in his presence, to experience power and potential in the moment. This is an invitation. It's an invitation to a wise, peaceful, fruitful, powerful life, grounded not in what we can do, but grounded in what God has made available to us in this moment. And so may we be people who make the most of the opportunity that God has placed in front of us, because it's an opportunity that will never come again. And as we offer the invitation song this morning, it's an opportunity for you to respond, to ask for prayers, to repent, to put Jesus on in baptism. It's an opportunity that you'll never have again in this moment. So why don't we make the most of it? Let's stand and sing together.